Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, the Eiffel Tower closed down, and France's high-speed trains stood still Thursday as labor unions launched nationwide strikes. The unions are protesting the government's plan to reform the retirement system. Officials in Paris set up barriers around the home of France's president and deployed 6,000 police officers as activists gathered for a march through the city. Many of the protesters wore yellow vests. The strikes are the biggest test to the president since the Yellow Vest Movement for Economic Justice was launched a year ago. Organizers hope a mass show of anger toward his reform plan will force the government to make concessions. To Macron, the reforms are central to his effort to make France more competitive internationally. His government argues that the country's 42 retirement systems need to be simpler and more effective. All French retirees receive a government pension, but there are differences across the retirement systems. People working for private businesses are part of the general pension system. They make up about 7 in 10 workers. But experts and professionals in many fields have a special pension plan. Some people, like railroad workers and flight crews, are permitted to take early retirement. Others, like doctors and lawyers, pay less tax. Macron wants to replace the retirement system with a unified plan, so that all workers have the same pension rights. While some private sector workers welcome Macron's reform, others support the strikers. Public sector workers fear Macron's reform will force them to work longer than those in the private sector. They also fear it will reduce the size of their pensions. They see the strike as an effort to save France's protections for workers.
When Craig and Vicky Leutold opened the Merry Hill Winery in 2001, there were about 100 wine producers in the American state of Washington. That number has since grown to more than 1,000 wineries this year, and that growth is likely to continue. Merry Hill Winery is part of that growth. The business makes 60 kinds of wine. It recently opened tasting rooms for its products in the cities of Spokane and Vancouver, Washington. It also is in the process of opening a tasting room just outside Seattle. "Our timing was great," Craig Leutold told the Associated Press. Washington wine has really increased in popularity. The state of Washington has become a force in the wine industry. It has the second highest number of wineries in the United States, after California. But California, which has around 3,700 wineries, remains a much bigger part of the industry than any other state. It sells more than $40 billion worth of wine nationwide. Within the United States, wines from California are the top sellers, followed by wines from Australia and Italy. Steve Warner noted that Washington finished in fourth place. Warner is president of Washington State Wine, the industry's trade group. More Washington wine is sold in the United States than French wine, he said. The state's wine industry earns about $2.4 billion a year and adds more than $7 billion a year to the state's economy, Warner said. Washington's wines are always highly rated, he added. We are competing against wine regions with 28 generations of winemakers who were doing it before America was a country, he said. Warner noted most of the industry's success comes from the state's climate and soils. Grapes, the small round fruit used to make wine, like long sunny days and cool nights. Grape growers in the central and eastern part of Washington enjoy those conditions. The area also gets little rainfall compared with other grape-growing regions, which is a plus, said Warner. Thomas Hennick Kling is director of the Wine Studies and Grape Growing Program at Washington State University in Pullman, Washington. He said the state still has plenty of available land at reasonable prices in wine country. The land being set aside for wineries is expanding. 20 years ago, there were fewer than 10,000 hectares of grapes. Today, there are nearly 24,000 hectares. Washington also has skilled farmers and winemakers, graduates of winemaking programs at several local colleges, Hennick Kling said. Washington's growth is no surprise, as the number of wineries and wine consumption continue to grow in the United States. I'm Pete Musto.
If you have been studying English, even for a short time, chances are you have already heard or read hundreds of collocations. A collocation is a group of two or more words that is almost always used together. Here are a few examples. Heavy rain. Big decision. Break a habit. Make a mistake. It would sound strange if someone said, huge rain, large decision, finish a habit, or do a mistake. Most people would understand the meaning, but native English speakers would never combine words in that way. We would not say, for instance, I'm hoping to hear about the large decision later today. The point is that some words go together in English and some do not. There is no grammatical reason why, and that sometimes makes collocations difficult for English learners. If you don't know, for example, that big decision is a collocation, it is not so easy to guess. Another thing that can make these things tricky is that many English words have several collocations. For instance, the word decision can be used in difficult decision, final decision, and many others. Today on Everyday Grammar, we will give you 3 practice exercises on collocations. Improving your use of collocations will help your English sound more natural, which will make you more easily understood. One of the best ways to look for collocations is to read and listen to many things in English. This will help you start to recognize them when you see and hear them. In this first exercise, you will hear a short story with several collocations. Most in the story begin with common verbs such as have, get, make, and take. But note that collocations can be made of any part of speech, not just verbs, but also nouns, adverbs, and adjectives. Now listen to the story and write down as many collocations as you hear.
We had plans to meet some good friends by 11. So this morning I took a shower by 9. As I was making the bed, I could hear heavy rain outside. I checked the weather and saw it was going to be a cold, wet day. So I got dressed in warm clothes. My husband made breakfast. The pancakes were tasty, but whenever he cooks, he makes a mess. But he did wash the dishes, so I can't complain. So anyway, we took the train and met our friends at a holiday market. We had a great time, but probably spent too much money.
So, what did you find? Here are the verb-noun collocations. Have plans, make the bed, take a shower, check the weather, make breakfast, make a mess, wash the dishes, take the train, have a good time, and spend money. You also heard the adjective-noun collocations, good friends, heavy rain, and warm clothes, and the verb-verb collocations, get dressed, and can't complain. This gives you some idea of just how much we use them. They are everywhere. Okay, on to the second exercise, using a collocation dictionary. Earlier, I told you that some English words have many collocations. So let's take a few words from the story and see what I mean. You can find a few good collocation dictionaries online, such as freecollocation.com. Now, try looking up the word make and find 2 collocations that were not in the story. Then, look up the word time and find 2 collocations that were not in the story. For make, you might, for example, find make an effort and make money. For time, you might, for example, find free time and take your time. Again, there are many possibilities for each word. These are just a few. Using a collocation dictionary can be helpful, but do not attempt to make long lists and memorize them. Instead, note just a few collocations every time and write a sentence or two for each that relates to your own life. For example, for free time, you might write, "I wish I had more free time during the week." Or, "I will finally have free time when I go home for the holiday." Then, try using some of these in your real-life conversations. All right, that brings us to the third practice activity. TV or television programs can teach you a lot about collocations. One way to use them is to observe and note the collocations you find in a few minutes of dialogue on a TV show or movie. Then, Just as in the last exercise, write a sentence for each that you might use in real life and practice using it sometime in conversation. Another fun thing you might try is a little less usual. Some of you may remember the 1990s British TV show Mr. Bean. On the show, Mr. Bean would find humorous solutions to the problems of everyday life, like shopping, going to restaurants, traveling, or celebrating holidays. But here is what's unusual about the show. There is almost no dialogue. So, in this activity, you are testing which collocations you can name without hearing anyone speaking. On our website, you will find a short video of Mr. Bean. Watch the video and try to name a few collocations to describe the place, people, things, and actions you see. If you're unsure whether something is a collocation, you can check it in a collocation dictionary. And don't forget to tell us what you find. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. 2 years of a bitter, bloody civil war started to show their effects on both the Confederate States of the South and the Union States of the North. Both sides began to feel the pressure of the costly struggle. The South, however, felt the pressure more severely because it was weaker in troop strength and industrial strength. Morris Joyce and Jack Moyles discuss the early summer of 1863 in the American Civil War.
In 1863, the Confederate States were becoming short of supplies. Food and guns were difficult to find to keep the Confederate armies in the field. Men were also needed. More and more men. There seemed to be no end to the demand for men to fill the places left empty by dead and wounded soldiers. Many in the South were heavy of heart, and hope among them slowly started to sink. The war was tiring. Its suffering was more than they could bear. And the situation in the West made matters worse. Union armies were on the move in the states of Mississippi and Tennessee. Their successes were becoming a serious threat. They might soon win control of the whole Mississippi River. This would split the states of the Confederacy and might end its very existence. Something was needed to raise up the spirits of the South, to break the pressure of Union armies. General Robert E. Lee believed that he had the answer, an invasion of the North. This, he felt, would throw fear into the people of the North and weaken the Union war effort. Lee had organized an army of 75,000 men at Fredericksburg, Virginia, halfway between Washington and Richmond. Lee began moving his men June 3rd. They marched northwest into the Shenandoah Valley. The valley led north to the Potomac River. Across the river was the narrow neck of western Maryland, then Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was the target. Its rich farmland produced plenty of food
enough to feed Lee's hungry army for the summer. Standing in the way of Lee's army was a small Union force at Winchester in Northern Virginia. There were only 7,000 Union soldiers, and they had no idea that the Confederate army was nearby. The Confederates easily defeated them. More than half of the Union troops were captured. The others fled. Now, there was nothing to stop Lee from... The huge Army of the Potomac was behind him, near Washington. The Union commander, General Hooker, had to keep the army between Lee and Washington to prevent the Confederates from seizing the national capital. Lee's army crossed western Maryland and entered Pennsylvania. His soldiers found the Pennsylvania countryside very different from Virginia's. Virginia had been a battleground for 2 years, and the land showed it. Farms had been destroyed. Its stores were empty. Pennsylvania had not been touched by the war. Its big farms were rich. Its towns and villages were full of food and goods of all kinds. The hungry, poorly clothed soldiers could not believe their eyes. This was the land of the enemy, they cried, and they could take whatever they wished. But General Lee said no. He said supplies could be taken only by Confederate supply officers. And, he said, they must pay in Confederate money for everything they took. Lee did not want to anger these people in Pennsylvania. Many of them did not support the Union war effort. Some of the rich farmers said openly that they did not care who won the war. They said they only wanted to be left alone. Lee was sure that many in the North felt the same way. There had been signs that people were growing tired of the war. Coal miners in eastern Pennsylvania had shown their feelings toward the war a few months earlier. They rose up against a new law drafting men into the Union Army. The miners did not want to fight. They refused to join the army. They rioted and attacked officials who tried to take them. Soldiers were sent to the mining areas to put down the riots.
Farmers in nearby Ohio also rebelled against the draft law. They refused to be drafted. Instead, they took guns and battled soldiers who came to arrest them. Feelings against the war were growing stronger, not only in Pennsylvania and Ohio, but also in several other farm states of the North. These areas saw a growing support for a peace party, a political party opposed to the war. Leaders of this movement were Democrats called Copperheads. They got this name because they wore on their coats a copper penny with the head of an Indian.
The chief Copperhead was a former... His name was Clement Vallandigham. As a member of Congress, Vallandigham criticized the war and the Republicans. He told them, "The war for the Union is in your hands, a most bloody and costly failure. War for the Union was abandoned, and war for the Negro was openly begun with stronger effort than before. With what success? Vallandigham asked. Let the dead at Fredericksburg and Vicksburg answer. Vallandigham said he wanted peace, and he wanted it immediately. He offered a simple program. Stop the fighting, make a ceasefire, and let some friendly foreign nation negotiate peace then south.
After he lost his seat in Congress, Vallandigham opened a campaign to become governor of Ohio. He traveled all across the state, speaking out against the war. He said Republicans did not want peace. He said they wanted to fight until every black man was free. The Union military commander for Ohio was General Ambrose Burnside, a former commander of the Army of the Potomac. After losing the Battle of Fredericksburg, Lincoln removed Burnside as Army commander and sent him to Ohio. Burnside was worried. Too many people in Ohio opposed the war. He believed that much of what was being said and done in Ohio was close to the crime of treason. Burnside announced several new measures to quiet the opponents of the war. One of these orders limited the right of citizens to criticize government military policy. Another declared that statements of support for the enemy would be punished as treason. Vallandigham refused to recognize Burnside's right to give such orders to civilians. On May 1st, he made a campaign speech to a big crowd at Mount Vernon, Ohio. He denounced Burnside's orders and spoke of the president as King Lincoln. Vallandigham claimed that Lincoln was using the war to become a dictator. He said Lincoln did not want peace, that the president had rejected peace offers from the South. Once again, he said the war was not a struggle for the Union, but a fight to free the slaves of the South. And he said, men of Ohio, who let themselves be drafted into the Union Army, were no better than slaves themselves. Burnside had sent several army officers to listen to the speech. When they reported what Vallandigham said, Burnside ordered his arrest. Without question, the man had violated the general's orders. Late the next night, soldiers went to Vallandigham's home in Dayton. They knocked on the door and said they had come to arrest him. Vallandigham called for help and refused to let the soldiers enter. They broke down the door, seized him, and took him to a military prison in Cincinnati. A few days later, Vallandigham went on trial before a military court in Cincinnati. That will be our story in the next program of The Making of a Nation.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
This is VOA News. I'm David Berg.